looks like it's a blank, come to my table, I'll show you what's really I'm sure many of us share the affection for reference books, dictionaries and atlases and encyclopedias, not only as beautiful objects, but for me, they really are great examples of how the reader will use information and navigate the book. As a kid, I used to sit at home with our World Book Encyclopedia and wonder at a book that could hold all of the world's knowledge. I'd also get very distracted as I was going to do my homework reports on Costa Rica and start looking at all of the other encyclopedia entries and the illustrations and the drawings of naked people. But the interesting thing about a reference book is that it represents a system of thinking that really is fascinating to me. And that system of thinking was prevalent at that point in time. So it becomes possible to track changes in thinking, changes in thought, from the printed thing you have in your hand to whatever it is we know of that moment. It's the marvelous thing about a library is that you can take those milestones of thought and track that influence. And that's where the title of my talk today comes from. And it's what this project of mine with Diderot is all about. But reference books, as we all know, and the really nice ones, are big and expensive and long in production, and they're actually some of the first casualties of the printed age, or the digital age, I'm sorry. Most people don't really want a static piece of information in their hands when information today is valued as this really fluid commodity. So there really probably won't be any more printed encyclopedias, and pretty soon we'll see, I think, the other reference books go that same direction. The problem with that is that those wonderful objects are really considerate of the reader's experience in a way that I think is profoundly unique to those books. And I love those systems of understanding how those correlations and those great leaps of the imagination between bits of information can happen. They're almost like big nervous systems, you know, where the informational pieces are like the neurons, and then you make these great leaps across the synapse of these spaces between things. And the system of organization represents those kind of synaptic leaps for me. So over time, you know, all things get repackaged with new names, and we resell them as new things that people can spend more on, and certainly designers are very experienced and expert at that. And occasionally I have open houses in my studio, and last June I had an open house, and it was filled with people, and they were looking at the unbound pages of Diderot, and this one young guy comes up to me, and he's extremely enthusiastic and, you know, bouncing up and down how great it is that people are still doing things the old way with all of this old equipment. And, you know, look at my print shop. It looks like a museum, and it's so old and wonderful when you use your hands. And, you know, I'm feeling all my buttons being pushed because that, as we all know, has so little to do with actually what we are about and what it is we make. And so I stopped the guy and I said, you know, what kind of work do you do? And he says, oh, he says, I'm an interaction and experience designer. And so I looked at him and said, really? I said, me too. So this is a book not about the encyclopedia. I may have thought it was when I started, but as often happens, as we make the actual book, we discover a real subject. It's a book about the idea of the encyclopedia, an organizational system that can be referenced and correlated one idea to another. And even more, it is a physical record of the correlations that were triggered for me while working with this material. The book was conceived through the lens of the camera, and it is a chronicle of the process of looking closely at a very familiar thing. I spent many sessions in our Special Collections Library at Washington University photographing the plate volumes of the encyclopedia, and then organizing in my studio my photos on my computer by category and common theme. These categories developed because they were the subjects at the heart of my work in teaching, the hand, the object, tools, machines, craft, sensation, perceptions, and dreams. So it might more accurately be described as a book of, or with, or even because of the encyclopedia. After several sessions shooting the plates, I realized that my photos had become increasingly focused on the smallest details of the engravings. I began cataloging those details under three major categories: the hand, the object, and the senses, which form the structure of the three volumes of this book. I'm fascinated by patterns, visual patterns, conceptual patterns, and patterns of influence. We are innately pattern makers and perceivers. It's the way we bring order to our world, by arranging objects into groups, making them accessible, knowable, and usable for ourselves and for others. Patterns group things in a field, and the space between things, the field, is of a perceptual importance equal to the things themselves. It is those spaces in between that hold great power for me when I think about the design of books. When we make a book, we are making patterns, visually and conceptually. So a central theme of the book is patterns, the meaning we derive from them, and the pleasure we take in making them. Illustrations from the original plate volumes are the heart of the book. They form surface textures by virtue of their engraved lines, and they combine with each other or with typography to form more complex patterns. I'm also fascinated by tools, and the encyclopedia is chock full of them. It was surprising to learn that more than half of the 3,000 plus plates are about craft and handwork, comprising a beautiful dictionary of mundane everyday objects and tools in an amazing variety of forms. I want to re-emphasize that my work with the encyclopedia began purely as a visual exploration through the camera. I don't think I would ever have gained the sense of the plates that I did without exploring them first through the lens and then on the screen of my computer. When I began work with the encyclopedia, I consciously avoided the enormous body of scholarship about the encyclopedia because I didn't want to prejudice the way I saw and read the plates. And you really must read these plates. There are no captions on or next to the plates themselves, so we are pressed into a very different way of reading than we are used to if we want to make sense of the engravings. And for me to be on the program today with Mr. Manguel is a real honor and an amazing coincidence, because at some point in my early workings, before I really started the work with study of the literature, but had been deeply into the plates, I was enjoying myself reading The Library at Night, a really wonderful book that I recommend to everyone. And I was in this blissful kind of ignorant state of Diderot, and then all of a sudden that got wrecked by Mr. Manguel as he introduced a kind of thought system of Diderot in his book right smack in the middle, and that ruined everything for me. So Mr. Manguel, it's my chance to publicly thank you for propelling me to actually learn something about what I was doing. That study began with the preliminary discourse to the encyclopedia, authored by Diderot's co-editor, Jean-Laurent d'Alembert, in which he lays out the encyclopedia's organizational structure in a beautiful visual map called the System of Human Knowledge. That system, a marvelous piece of information design, organizes encyclopedia entries in nested categories under three uber categories: memory, reason, and imagination. And this number three figures prominently into my book, both conceptually and visually. Some of my conceptual organization is consistent with the encyclopedia system, but for slightly different reasons. For instance, for Diderot, the crafts, because of their link with natural materials, were categorized under natural history, a subcategory of memory. For me, that association correlated to an important link between memory and the hand, that many of our first memories are born in the hand as we explore the sensual world of objects and materials. So the nature of the narrative of my book moves like this: a meditation on craft and the hand, the role of tools and machines and their impact on human development, the concept of work, labor, and leisure, and finally, the way sensation and perception shape our internal and external worldview. The formal construct of Threes also drove some of the visual devices, including these gridded typographic constructions of the word encyclopedia, which repeat throughout the book almost as a mantra, and change through several iterations. These function as markers of a conceptual shift in content and reflect on the definition of the word encyclopedia, which means literally from the Greek, a chain of knowledge. And reflecting on this as that definition might shift and change over the course of the narrative of the book. In this version, the encyclopedia plate transitions from fully transparent at top to fully opaque at the bottom. And this plate, I have to say, this page of the book was produced in late August as the result of a conversation that a few people in this room and I had about rainbow rolls and their pleasure in making them. And I went back to the studio and I said, damn it, I'm going to do one of those. Here's another one of those iterations of the encyclopedia late in the third section, sensation and perception. I like to devise visual metaphors that drive the design of a book, and the most important single design feature in this book is transparency, achieved through the use of ink and paper. This was originally driven by a desire to interpret one of the most important of Diderot's revolutionary concepts in the encyclopedia, his call for a transparent society that endorsed a free currency of ideas for all citizens. I worked with the transparency of the paper by using it as an additional layer in reading images through the sheet, changing perception of the image with each page turn. Quite often, it was actually the verso of the sheet image, the verso of the sheet with image modified by the layer of the paper that was the intention of the printing. The transparency was also a powerful metaphor for memory. How memory is constructed, not as discrete experiences, but of layers of one experience over another. And finally, it is a manifestation of what our friend Ruth Rogers likes to call the ineffable effect of the book. The transparent layers of papers and inks are employed to create an animated, almost cinematic approach to the quality of the reading experience. Books are sequential experiences, and the challenge of shifting that sense of sequentiality was exploited by the transparency of the materials. There are several sequences in the book, groupings of pages where page turns modify the reading as an image overlays and reflects the others, the result being that some images are constructed by reading through up to four paper surfaces. This is a section on the hand with a bit of writing over the mannequin that is a piece of my writing about my hand. The what of the book. The title, Diderot Project, derives from Diderot's own choice of referring to his work as the Encyclopedia Project. I like the word project because it implies a dynamic, ongoing work. Project also functions as both verb and noun, it's another duality that I really like. The book is 148 pages, 220 press runs, printed with 8 pounds of ink, silver, transparent, gold, and black. 6 different papers were used, from commercial vellums to sheets handmade at Dieudonné paper mill, with 3 watermarks I designed for this edition. Using multiple papers is in part a reference to the encyclopedia's publisher, André Le Breton, and his struggle to maintain paper supply for the encyclopedia production during the 20-plus years of its printing. I want to thank Sue Gosen and Paul Wong of Dieudonné Paper for their friendship and help with this paper. It was exceptionally gratifying to work with Dieudonné again, after having last made paper there well over 30 years ago, in my beginning at Red Osier Press. It's really where I started my career. And the amazing thing is that Sue and Paul and I, we look exactly the same. It's really on the camera. Oh, you can see that watermark, right?
Yes.
Good. Here is the second watermark on the right that is the reflection of the divider. The first volume, The Hand, Diderot considered the workshops a great source of France's wealth, not merely for the products they made, but for the particular knowledge that is the product of working with one's hand. For him, the workshops were hothouses of innovation and experimentation. He understood this from birth. His father was a master metalsmith and maker of surgical blades. I think this explains the emphasis on rendering the artisans in their workshop in such intimate, almost loving detail. In several entries, Diderot laments the lowly status in French society of those who work with their hands. He writes, "We are all too inclined to believe that it is beneath the dignity of the human spirit to apply oneself diligently and continuously to specific and concrete experiments and objects, and that our mind forgets its dignity when it descends to the study, let alone the practice, of the mechanical arts. The mind here stoops to questions in which research is laborious, reflection inglorious, and exposition difficult. This prejudice has tended to fill the cities with useless spectators and with proud men engaged in idle speculation, and the countryside with petty tyrants who are ignorant, lazy, and disdainful."
Here, here. Vive la révolution.
Pretty good. So his voice was kind of really, you know, that fierce, damning voice was something that really gave me a lot of energy during this project. Volume 2 is concerned with the object and primarily the tool. This volume is concerned with our relation to everyday objects, tools, and machines. Two tools found in almost every plate on the crafts are the hammer and the divider, or the compass. And I took them as my ur tools of the encyclopedia, the yin and yang of tool-ness. The hammer is the extension of a hand that lends weight and force and steel to the conversation between mind and material. It has an irreducible character and remains virtually unchanged in its shape and function since its original design. The divider, or compass, does not shape anything other than thought. It is a more modern idea of tool as collector of information. This section also looks at typologies and how we organize things into groups of likenesses for comparison and contrast. In volume 3, this final section addresses visual perception, patterns, dreams, the animal world, and the importance of the ability to shift one's perspective. Early in the project, I began experimenting with word and image constructs that grew to include selections of 40 writers, philosophers, neuroscientists, poets, and critics, juxtaposed with and overlaid onto the images. The major voices, in terms of sheer number of words, are Diderot's entries from the encyclopedia and my own writing done for this project. As the images and texts were coalescing into a narrative, I determined to create a robust typographic system, or matrix, that would accomplish three things. First, it would create a strong visual contrast to the images. Second, it had to reflect different voices on the page, using the typeface Walbaum for Diderot's writing and Trade Gothic for the contemporary texts. And third, it would infuse the subject of that individual volume with its own typographic identity. In the first section, the type is shaped with soft curves to evoke the sense of material shaped in the hand. The second section has the sharp angularity of a material shaped by tools. The final section has a typography that, at time, challenges the visual perceptual system and the way we read. This complexity demanded a design matrix that could maintain continuity while being adaptable to improvisation. I was designing each signature as we were printing and editioning the previous one. This isn't a system that I would recommend to anyone. But it lent a certain tension and risk to the production that I had never experienced before. And I really, really liked. There was something electric in the studio. I'd wanted for some time to develop a project in which I could improvise on a theme as I went along. The model for this form of improvisation for me is John Coltrane and his version of the song My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music. At the beginning of each book design course I teach, I play a recording of Julie Andrews singing this song from the movie. And then I play John Coltrane. And I tell my students that everything they want to know about book design is in the way John Coltrane has played that piece of music. I also tell them that it's entirely okay to be confused at the beginning of the semester. The typography is shaped throughout the book, sometimes subtly, sometimes more aggressively. But the goal wasn't to make shapes or pictures out of the words as much as it was to mold and animate the space surrounding the words, to activate it as a metaphor for the spaces in which I believe the correlations, associations, and imaginative leaps are actually made. I liken the unprinted parts of the page to the synapses between the neurons, those electrical bridges that make connections really come alive. And the blackness of the paper became an important aspect, also unpredicted at the beginning of this project, an important aspect of the visuality because of the way the images appeared to invert when printing them as silver on black. The why of the project. This project resonates so deeply for me because it unexpectedly linked the two major subjects of my research in the last several years. The work I had done in India with study of the encyclopedia. In fact, my time in India, and I've spent a total of about 18 months there since my first trip in 2003, was one of the most important catalysts for this project in two significant ways. First, my work there focuses on artisans in their workshops, how they think and how they work. Reading the plates of the encyclopedia, I realized that Diderot and I were looking at exactly the same phenomenon, the hands, tools, and body postures of the makers. We both saw the workshops as rich location of innovation and design thinking, and as places of insights that develop directly from performance of repeated actions. The encyclopedia plates emphasize the artisans and the way they worked, not the product of their labor. The artists who drew the encyclopedia plates were instructed to go to the workshops and, quote, observe without confusion, because they could not expect explanation from the artisans who were not used to talking about their process. In 1750, writing in the preliminary discourse to the encyclopedia, Diderot's co-editor D'Alembert explains this with what I think is one of the most beautiful lines ever written about studio practice that you see on the left-hand page. In the workshop, it is the moment that speaks and not the artisan. On the right-hand page are some of my friends that I've collected along the way from the photographing of these plates. As a way to quickly move through the transitions and patterns of the entire book, I've created a slideshow of the entire book spreads. There are some 70 spreads to consider, but don't worry, they're only 2.4 seconds per slide, so it'll be over before you know it. And I'm sorry, there's no music.
Yeah, sing beautiful things.
Drops on roses. each section, there's a bibliography that you see here with the first few words of each line of the entry.